This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the program, we'll have an update on the Indian Ocean tsunamis, what scientists knew and now know. It certainly is one I think would probably qualify now as the biggest news story of the year, in a year which saw no shortage of science and technology-related news. And we started off the year with news that South Korean scientists had cloned a human embryo with the aim of harvesting embryonic stem cells. Stem cells were certainly in the news all year, as was space exploration, especially on Mars. We also had a Cassini probe that went out to the larger planets. We have also the recall of the drug Vioxx, which caused a huge stir and was followed by questions about the ability of the FDA to monitor the drug industry. And you'll remember we had a winner of the X Prize, the first private company to send a person into space. I can go on and on about the news. And guess what? We will go on this hour. Not me, hopefully. You've heard enough of me. We're going to review the top science and technology stories of the year. We want to hear from you. What stories do you think are worth revisiting? Perhaps there was something that caught your imagination that the rest of us missed. That's quite probable. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. John Rennie is the editor-in-chief of Scientific American here in New York. He's with us in our Science Friday studios. Welcome back to the program, John.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Ira, as always.
Casey Cole is a science writer currently on leave from the L.A. Times in Los Angeles. She joins us from the studios of Southern California Public Radio in Los Angeles. Welcome back.
Nice to be here.
She's also the author of Mind Over Matter, Conversations with the Cosmos. Don Kennedy is editor-in-chief of the journal Science. He joins us today by phone from Stanford. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Kennedy.
Thanks, Ira.
John Rennie, what do you think? What's on your top of your list?
Well, I would certainly have to agree with that. You know, the sort of exploration of Mars is certainly, you know, it's a dream people have had for so many years. And as Don just said, you know, Stephen Squires and his group at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, you know, the work they did in pulling together these sort of robotic explorers is really fantastic. And it does point very well to just the kinds of terrific expeditions we can continue to make throughout the solar system using robots.
Casey, you weren't so happy with the number one of last year's science list. What, do you think they got it right this year?
Yes. I mean, in terms of the actual findings of water on Mars, it was great to confirm a lot of things, and they got a lot of wonderful new pieces to the puzzle. But I agree, it's really the robotic technology. It was amazing to go out during those landings and look at the planet Mars and think that people on Earth had basically thrown like a slingshot these little rovers, and they had arrived pinpoint and then bounced down and opened their little pedals and, you know, run around with all these great instruments and done geology. But we also had Hubble, for example, which got a nice reprieve, I hope, this year, and a lot of other it just was a great year proving the potential that you can do great science without necessarily having humans. And in fact, humans would probably do science that was not as of high quality as robots.
I do, if I can stick one point
sure, go
in
ahead.
Here, I think it also raises an interesting political question, because funds are limited and there's going to be a competition between funds for the extraordinary kinds of unmanned exploration that we're now able to do, and the rather ambitious proposal of a moon to Mars hop, skip, and jump. And I think that's going to have to be decided, and I think it's going to be interesting to watch it work itself out.
I think that's an excellent point, actually. I mean, I think that we have more or less a certain set of loose promises from the administration that these very ambitious plans to try to go back to the moon and for a long-term attempt to a human visit to Mars, that this isn't really going to come at the expense of the sort of good robotic pure basic science that the space program can also do. But I think it's really very questionable to think that in the long run is going to – that those promises are going to hold up.
Casey, this was also a political year in science, where
yes.
The scientists were very vocal about the criticism of the White House.
Right. I was going to say, to my mind, in a way, from being at meetings and so forth, this, in a sense, seemed to be the biggest story, but it's not unconnected to what has just been said. When you think about Hubble, for example, just very shortly after the president announced the Moon-Mars initiative, the Hubble servicing flight was canceled, supposedly for safety reasons. Not many people bought into that. They did think it was a money thing. Mm-hmm. Then you had a huge outcry from everybody, including school children, raising money, and Barbara Mikulski saying you have to get a second opinion. And then just recently, the National Academy of Sciences saying, you know, we really think we ought to have a shuttle mission to service Hubble. So that was a case in which the political power of, you know, the people and scientists really had an impact. Elsewhere, things did not, at least so far, turn out so good. There is a wonderfully ambitious program called Beyond Einstein, which entails two other great observatories, a gravity wave telescope and an X-ray constellation of X-ray telescopes and a bunch of smaller probes. They have suffered greatly because of the Moon-Mars initiative already, even though the administration really isn't fessing up to that. And there's a very depressed atmosphere among a lot of astronomers because of that.
What about the future? You think this is going to continue, or you think this is do you think there's a permanent impact on science, or do you think this is an administration problem that this administration?
The scientists are really starting to fight back in a serious way. You know, it started with the Union of Concerned Scientists. It has grown into panels of little gangs of scientists, lots of Nobel laureates going around the country giving talks about how important it is. I mean, nobody thinks that scientists should tell the government what kind of science policy to have. But they do think that the government should listen to what the scientists have to say and take that information seriously. And that's what's not happening. And I've heard a lot of worries, even, for example, from the nuclear physics community about nuclear stewardship, stockpiles, new kinds of nuclear weapons, that all the civilian experts have basically been fired because the administration didn't like what they were saying. So that's what the controversy is. I think the scientists, like the school children in Hubble, are coming back and speaking loudly. And, you know, let's hope the balance is restored. I did notice that one of the top 10 of the science list was, what was it, Breakdown
of the Year. Don?
Yeah, we really thought that the launching of a kind of disaffection between the scientific community and its leadership and the White House and the White House science advisor is a discouraging and possibly important problem. I mean, there are really a couple of aspects to it. The first one involves really serious differences about two areas of research, stem cells and climate change. And the second one is the impression on the part of lots of people in the scientific community that people are being appointed to what are essentially scientific posts, that is, judging the quality of research and the like, on the basis of political partisanship rather than on the basis of their scientific credentials. No one denies that there are certain science positions that a newly elected president ought to be able to appoint in terms of agreement with a set of policies that he's brought to the office. But people who are on research evaluation committees ought to have, I think, a somewhat more objective view.
Can I throw in my two cents on this, too?
Absolutely.
You know, for what it's worth, I think that a lot of criticism, I think, has been very justly leveled at the administration about this. One of the things that I worry about is that what we've seen because of these administration activities, of what people worry about stacking the advisory committees and so forth, is that this may sort of be a manifestation of a deeper problem that may last long after this administration is gone. That is, that we may be seeing a sort of real erosion of the public trust in the idea of science or scientists as a kind of authority that they can turn to trust even on scientific matters. You look at the level of politicization about issues like global warming or stem cells or any of the rest, and it's going to be tempting, I'm afraid, for future administrations to tend to do exactly the same sort of stacking, no matter which side side of the political divide they're on.
It's interesting you bring that up because we had Dan Greenberg. I'm sure you know who Dan Greenberg is. He's been around forever. He was on the show and we were talking about this. And he said he thinks that if scientists want to change that, they have to become just as political. He said you got to become politically motivated. You've got to have your own group, your own affinity group, like they used to do in the old days.
I'm probably sympathetic to that point of view. Although I think there's a point of view that goes exactly the opposite way, that says that the smartest things for the scientists to do is to retreat back to a position of saying, "Here's what the science says. We're leaving the policy to somebody else."
Casey,
well, yeah, I was just going to jump. I mean, if you do that, well, let me go back for a second. In terms of leaving the policy to the government, one of the things about making these decisions on priorities on what kinds of research you want to do, whether it's in astrophysics or whether it's in biology, is that our scientists argue among themselves. So when they come to a consensus on what's important, you want that to be listened to, and there's a lot of discouragement when it isn't. But one of the other long-range effects of this, I mean, we're already seeing it, is that the center of the frontier of science is moving in many fields away from the United States. And that's very upsetting. The particle physics, the center is going to be now at CERN in Europe. You're hearing a lot of people who can't do their research here who are moving to other countries to do it where they get more support. Mm-hmm. So that's discouraging.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on because I got about a minute till the break. John, your second pick was this distant relative.
Well, that's right. This is really one of the most amazing stories, the discovery of our tiny, little, long-lost, distant cousins, Homo floresiensis, the discovery of these really cousins to humankind that were only 1 meter tall. They developed on a small island near Java, and they seem to be a species of human being that we have never known about and that we shared the planet with maybe as recently as just 13,000 years ago.
It was fascinating. You're right. It is how short a time ago that was.
That's right.
And what other – maybe there are others we haven't found yet either.
Well, I mean, what's impressive is if you think about it in this context, it means that if you go back to maybe, say, 30,000 years ago, there were probably at least four different types of people on this planet, Homo sapiens, Homo erectus, which was the type of person that gave rise to Homo floresiensis, and the Neanderthals, who were in Europe. I mean, it's amazing. There used to be many different types of people here, and now we're the only ones that are left.
The striking thing to me about this is that if the date is right, and there's no reason to question it at this point, then for at least 30 or 40,000 years, these tiny, small-brained people coexisted with big, bad, aggressive Homo sapiens who had arrived 40 or 60,000 years ago in the same region, had watercraft, had gotten to many of these islands, surely got to this one.
Don, you got to hold that thought because we have to take a break. But we'll come right back and talk more about the big stories. We'll pick up the end of this track on somebody who was living somebody else at the same time we were. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the year in science. A lot of stuff happened during the year. We're talking about it with Casey Cole, a science writer currently on leave from the LA Times, author of Mind Over Matter, Conversations with the Cosmos, Donald Kennedy, editor-in-chief of the journal Science, John Rennie, editor-in-chief of Scientific American. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. When I rudely interrupted, Don Kennedy was talking about this little period. You said 30,000 years when we were in existence with our competitors.
Well, I think the remarkable thing, as I was saying, is that for at least 30 and maybe 40,000 years, these small-brained people isolated on the island of Flores lived with large, aggressive, modern human beings, Homo sapiens, just like you and me.
Yeah.
And these modern people had watercraft, had gotten all over the place. It's inconceivable that there wasn't some interaction. Wouldn't it be interesting to know what it was?
Yeah.
And of course, there were those sort of stories Yes, there were, of course, these stories that legends within this area on the island of there were creatures like this that may have persisted up until the time that the Dutch settlers came to those islands, like in the 1500s. So, nobody really knows how long some of these creatures might might have persisted, though it's probably pretty unlikely that they were there.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Todd in Reno. Hi, Todd.
Good morning.
Good afternoon to you.
I wanted to make my personal plug for the Hubble. It's my favorite. I thoroughly enjoy Astronomy Picture of the Day and all that. I love the reliance on technology and the fact that it evolved so quickly. It's fascinating and it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. But there is a darker side to it. My pick for this past year's technological story is the dangers involving the reliance on technology, specifically the internet and the fraud and crimes, specifically identity theft, that I think those risks and dangers don't get quite enough notice.
Casey?
I'm not sure I would put those two at all in the same category. I agree with you, but there's very little danger that anybody's going to commit any kind of fraud or hurt us through the Hubble. I would like to say it is interesting what you say about the Hubble and the robots and how they've touched us. One of the odd things in the argument for going to Moon and Mars that I think President Bush said we need humans to touch things is that since the moon landing in 69, when it was important to have actual people somewhere, these various kinds of robots have managed to touch us in such amazing ways to take us places, take us to the surface of Mars, take us to the edge of the universe, that they're just like our eyes and ears out there. That's not quite like the internet, which is more like this complex community, almost a living thing, which is much more easy to do damage to, but I would be interested to hear what your other guests had to say.
Don Kennedy?
Well, I think an interesting thing about the Hubble and the repair mission for the Hubble, I'm delighted that it's going to happen. In that particular case, the National Academy of Sciences Committee has now recommended that it be done with a manned mission rather than with a robotic mission, which Administrator O'Keefe had favored. So that may be a case in which at least some wise heads think that you would need to touch it.
Absolutely. But I would say that's because the Hubble was designed to be serviced by the shuttle.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That is an exception. That's clear exception, right?
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go out to Henry in Kensington, Maryland. Hi, Henry.
Hi, Ira. Thanks so much for taking my call, and thanks so much for sponsoring a forum, an end-of-year forum, is to where science has gone. My comment is on the dark side again of science, and I'm pulling directly from Washington Post articles this year about how we find out the truth of science. You've already touched a little bit about the Vioxx incident and about this extraordinary situation now where FDA scientists are under the protection of Congress so that the people can find out what's really going on scientifically. At least that's the perception. And the other story that I wanted to point out was the ongoing congressional investigation of the top scientists at the NIH leadership. They supervise a budget of $26 billion, and for the last 9 months, Congress has been horrified to find that they've created their own pay system, their own series of contracting arrangements with industry, and now all NIH employees are forced to have ethics training, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And it just seems odd to me that we have to find the science of what's going on through congressional investigations. That's the impression I'm getting.
Well, you know, if I can comment on that. I mean, I think first of all, I don't think anybody is going to defend any of the problems that have surfaced with sort of covert connections between industry and different researchers. And I think it's really deplorable to consider the idea that in some cases different industries or even senior scientists have done things to cover up different sorts of work that people have known. That the public should have known about or that should have borne on things like approval of pharmaceuticals. But, you know, one of the problems that the reason why all of these connections, these problems are showing up is because of the level of connection that now exists between what used to be the sort of purely academic research community and the industrial community. And this was the result of, frankly, decisions that were made within the government some time ago that we needed to do more to try to encourage turning pure scientific discoveries into applied technological discoveries. It used to be not so easy for people who were in the universities to be able to getting patents and to be forming alliances with the pharmaceutical companies, for example.
Ira knows that that I once spent some time as commissioner of the FDA, and so it won't be a surprise that I'm defending it a little bit here.
I can't remember back that far.
Right. You know, a big piece of the criticism, there are undoubtedly criticisms that are right and should be looked into. One of them is that FDA didn't have a way of finding out the hazards associated with already marketed drugs. And the fact of the matter is that the Congress has never given FDA either the mandate or the appropriations to mount a successful monitoring system for drug adverse reaction epidemiology in this country. There's a good one in Britain. We don't have one. There's no reason not to have one.
Right, well said. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. What about this little thing that happened this year that sort of got a bit of attention in physics about sort of like teleportation like in Star Trek? Casey?
Oh, I've been trying to figure out a simple way to explain quantum teleportation. Man,
spooky action at a distance.
Spooky action at a distance. Well, first of all, let me tell you why people are so interested, and it has to do with the fact that all of these weird quantum effects, or you know, stuff in physics that you think is so abstract, if it's never going to have any kind of technical application, is really going to fool you, and this is one of them. If you know, computers now work with binary on-off bits 1-0. A quantum state of anything, any kind of particle, is in multiple states at the same time. So it can have high energy, low energy, spin up, spin down, very kinds of combinations. It's like an undecided voter, okay? It's got all different kinds of ideas in its head at the same time. If you can use those multiple states to compute, you've suddenly got a much more powerful computer. But the problem is, if you try to measure whatever that state or combination of states is, you destroy it, because observing it basically makes it make a decision. I voted for Kerry or I voted for Bush. Now you've destroyed that richness of information. So you've got to figure out a way to get all that information from one place to the other, basically without touching it or without asking questions. And that's what quantum teleportation involves, through something that's known as entanglement, whereas you have a couple of particles. I'm thinking of me and my brother. If I voted for Kerry, he would surely vote for Bush. Whatever happens to one, whether we're on the other side of the world, if you ask me a question, he's going to know the answer. In other words, you do something to me and it has an effect on something far away. And through using that, you can actually ask questions of things, teleport information without actually teleporting matter or disturbing the state that you're looking at. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm. No. And Casey put that very, very well. And if I can just highlight one particular part of what you were saying, I think that, you know, when people hear teleportation and the fact that physicists are describing this as teleportation, they are, of course, immediately flashing onto the sort of Star Trek images of people getting beamed from place to place. I think it's probably very important in terms of people keeping people's expectations in a line, in alignment, that really this is the sort of work that may have much more application, frankly, in things like computer science and in cryptography, for example, than it is in actually, say, transportation.
Right, because everybody thinks about Schrodinger's cat, you know, which was the wonderful analogy that Schrodinger came up with to describe these multiple states where the cat is both alive and dead until you actually open the box and look at it, at which point it decides. But of course, no cat would ever be in that state. These states only apply to subatomic particles and mm-hmm. atomic states. Mm-hmm.
Don Kennedy, I want to move on a little bit. We've been talking about a lot of negative things recently, but there was an interesting list on the science list in ninth place that was sort of a positive advance in public health.
Well, I think one of the striking things that's happened is that a whole new set of kind of public-private partnerships has evolved to really start to put a massive effort into the interest of dealing with a whole category of newly emerging and old infectious diseases. The IAVI, the Global Fund, the robust participation of the Gates Foundation and its funds, the Carter Center teaming up with drug companies to deal with river blindness. There are just lots of examples now of different kinds of institutions, companies, foundations, governments, to really start to deal with these things. And it's awfully encouraging, I think.
John?
I think, you know, if we're talking about public health, one of the other, I think, promising areas of development in this past year had to do with malaria, at least on a couple of fronts. Malaria, of course, is probably the greatest infectious disease scourge the human race has ever known. I gather it's estimated that about 10% of all of the people who've ever lived have died of malaria. You have over 1 million people dying of it every single year. And these days there are two big problems with malaria. One of them is the sort of the basic technological problem. It's very hard to figure out ways to fight this parasite. And the other one, frankly, is financial and political, that very few people want to spend the money. The rich countries that have the money don't really feel like spending it. The poor countries that need malaria treatments and vaccines can't afford to pay for it. We had good developments in both of those fronts. On the technical side of it, first of all, there were more good studies having to do with artemisinin, which is a compound derived from an old Chinese herb. Mm-hmm. That seems like it's useful in being able to treat malaria. But also, there was a new early experimental vaccine that GlaxoSmithKline was testing in 2,000 children in Africa. And the nice thing was that it seemed as though that was able to actually prevent the disease from developing in 30% of them, and it was able to prevent the disease from progressing to a very serious state in about 60% of them. So that's very, very good. And a nice follow-up on that was that I think just last month the British government announced that it was going to buy 300 million doses of the vaccine as an incentive for GlaxoSmithKline to produce it.
1-800-989-8255 is a number. Let's go to Michael in Ithaca, New York. Hi, Michael. Happy New Year.
Hi, friends. Yeah, you too. Yeah, I want to say that I was particularly tickled and titillated by the sequencing of the genome of the red jungle fowl, which is exciting, too, because I guess the first dinosaur to be have its genome sequenced, and also because it exists in many semi-domesticated and domesticated variants, as well as, you know, more wild ones, and it would be interesting to look at its social behavior and see how, you know, which genes cause you know, whether they're monogamous or polygamous, and how politely they treat their rival males when they compete for them, and whether they distinguish brothers from non-brothers and when competing, and different things like this. It'd be interesting to see where on the genome these different traits and variations for them lie. And it just sounds like a great deal of work from the future will come from that, as well as just comparing its genome with our own, because it's close but not too close.
Right. I mean, if I can comment on that, which is,
well,
you know,
let me just remind everybody first that this is a Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Go ahead.
Oh, sure. The red jungle fowl in this case is behold the chicken. This is the creature that that we know that way much more commonly. That's the domesticated version of this, and this is, I think, the first avian that's had its genome process. So it does open up a whole new line of discovery about that. So, and of course, chickens are extremely important domestic animals, and so there are a lot of very important applications of this, is just into the production of future birds.
So now it's okay to ask, why did the dinosaur cross the road?
Right?
Because we're going to have the same.
So I think it's yeah, very interesting not only to have that one, but to have the dog, because in a way, these are cases in which artificial selection has produced a remarkable amount of what you could call phenotypic amplification against a relatively little modified genetic base. And we need to know a lot more about what's happening epigenetically to make organisms with very similar genomes look so different and act so different.
That's a really good point. You know, one of the other broad insights that came out of this past year was, of course, this year they also arrived at a more final assessment of how many genes there were just in the human genome. And we have 25,000 genes.
Right.
Now, this is one quarter of the number of the genes that people, you know, 10, 15 years ago assumed we would have had. And it's also basically exactly the same number of genes that you'll find in a mouse, and virtually the same number of genes you'll find in things like worms and bugs. So clearly all of our lofty, glorious complexity arises from something other than just numbers of genes, and it clearly has to do with what's holding the genes together, the other stretches of junk DNA.
Well, that's right here on our stage is where last year you made a prediction that we would know more about the junk DNA, and we did find out.
That's right.
Much
more has been discovered about how you have different sorts of regulatory elements inside all of those, and it's been a big year for
I have time to give each of you a prediction about 2005. John, you have any idea what the big story will be? You don't have to be right.
I think that in 2005 we are going to probably see I think that next year we're going to see that there's going to be more big developments in global warming. I think the evidence is going to be completely incontrovertible, and yet I think we're going to see the policy decisions change not one bit.
Mm-hmm. Don Kennedy?
I hope he's half right. I think that climate change and the evidence for climate change is going to take a big bump upward. And I think that we're reaching a point now at which the policies probably have to change.
Casey, before the break, then we'll come back and talk more about other stories. What's your prediction for next year?
Well, there's certainly going to be a continuation of these wonderful developments on the quantum mechanical front, both in terms of teleportation and in terms of these condensates, superconducting states, ways of using that. And, of course, out in space, Cassini, with a lot of missions we haven't talked about.
Oh, Huygens and things like that coming up. Yeah, okay, on the other side of the break, we'll do that. We're going to have to take a break. We're talking with Casey Cole, John Rennie, and Donald Kennedy about big stories 2004. Maybe we'll look ahead a little bit, as we are now, to anticipate what the big stories in 2005 will be next year. Take some more of your calls. Where do you think we're headed? Stay with us. We'll be right back. Don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the year in science with my guest, Casey Cole, science writer, currently on leave from the LA Times, Donald Kennedy, editor-in-chief of the journal Science, John Rennie, editor-in-chief of Scientific American. Our number 1-800-989-8255. We've been talking about the big news stories, and now we're going to uncover the little crystal ball that everybody loves to carry around with them and talk about what we might see coming up. Let me begin with you, Don Kennedy. Are we going to get an FDA commissioner? You brought up the subject.
that's way beyond me.
What is the problem in getting one, do you think?
I would like to bring junk DNA back into the picture for a moment.
Go ahead.
I think it was Sidney Brenner who said, with respect to calling it junk DNA, he said, well, garbage is what you throw out. Junk is what you put in the attic until you figure out what it's good for.
Oh, what a great quote.
And we're really starting to figure out what some of that is good for. There are the transposable elements. There are certainly sequences of DNA that are the templates for small pieces of RNA that act as interfering RNAs and affect the process of transcription. In other words, I think we're beginning to see that these long stretches that once were thought not to have anything terribly interesting may have most of the interest.
I was always shocked to see how anybody could have the chutzpah or hubris to call something junk DNA, something that's been around so long. How can we call it junk? You know? Maybe I'll be proven right. Casey, did you want to jump in there?
No, I was just going to say it's an old story in science. The cosmic microwave background was junk when it was discovered.
Right.
It's often there's an anomaly in some set of data that leads to some big new discovery. So it's a big theme.
All right, let's go on that theme and your specialty, which is physics and space. What about advances in this dark energy? Do you think this year we're going to learn anything more about what this mysterious stuff is?
Well, if we get, we'll always learn a little bit more, but we really need those beyond Einstein probes. They will help. They will give us a lot more information. So I don't think that's necessarily going to happen this year. I'll tell you one thing I hope that will happen, And another thing a little bit off the wall that I think might happen, the tsunami, which we haven't connected with what we're talking about. I was flying back across the country. I actually went to Stockholm for the Nobel Prizes because a friend won this year. And looking at the surface of the Earth, I was reading about Krakatoa, how everything seems so calm and quiet. And you realize there is this boiling violence underneath. And it's the same thing if you look down into atoms. Subatomic world is like that. Outer space is like that. You look in X-rays and gamma rays. This is an opportunity and a peril. The opportunity is there's a lot to be seen that we don't know about yet. The peril is we're not looking as deeply. For example, we have all these asteroids out there with our name on them.
You've got my number on that one. That's my big soapbox this year.
Yep, yeah, absolutely.
You know it's got our name on it. And we're going to be hit, but everybody ignores it.
Exactly. And, you know, the tsunami kind of thing is tragic. It's just horrific. Yeah. But it reminds us these things do happen. This is part of the history of the Earth. I don't want to take any more time, but if you...
absolutely
you
right.
You want me to talk about the anthropic principle?
No. Well...
No.
Yeah, well, while we're talking physics, let me just keep on another different subject that's kind of interesting. We're not sure where that's going to be going. Yeah. And that's string theory. I mean, it's kind of cool, but can we prove any of it? Is it more than just a religion among scientists?
Well, no, these things are connected, and there isn't a string theorist worth their salt who doesn't agree that you have to have experimental tests before it qualifies as an actual theory. But it's done so many miraculous things so far mathematically that people really believe in it. And this in the history of physics, that's often been the road that turns out to be true, although it's going to be a while. I do think you're going to hear a lot more talk about what I mentioned was the anthropic principle, partly because of string theory. And that is that if the universe is the way it is because we're here to view it, one of the problems with string theory is it predicts tens of thousands of different possible states that the universe could be in. So how come we're in this one? And everybody would like to show some reason that we're in this one. But maybe the reason is this is the only one we can actually survive in. Now, you never heard anybody, this is, the A word. It's a really bad word in physics and cosmology, anthropic. All of a sudden, you're hearing it discussed a lot. And the other reason
is... But John Wheeler talked about it years ago, didn't he?
That's right. But it was kind of swept under the rug. I've never heard a lot of serious talk about it. String theory and also cosmology has kind of forced people to begin to reconsider it. So that's a big underlying controversy that I think is kind of fun. I think you'll hear a lot more about.
And let me throw this out to all of you. Do you think we're going to see more butting heads of science and religion then, thinking of, taking that to a logical extension? Where people will say, well, we're here because God put us here.
I think we're going to see a lot more cases where obviously people are trying to pose science against religion or religion against science. I think that there's a real basic misunderstanding of the idea that these two have to be opposed to one another. Stephen Jay Gould, he always used to say that science and religion should be seen as two distinct, non-overlapping magisteria, that science has its broad province in which it is a very great, it is the great authority in being able to explain about how the physical universe operates. And religion is the great guide for metaphysics and for spiritual matters. Now, I think what is tricky is that, it was very convenient in Gould's formulation of this that they would be non-overlapping. I have to say that you can certainly find areas where they do touch one another, and, I think it is hard not to think that there are certainly, depending on what your specific religious beliefs are, it's easy to find cases in which science maybe is imposing on those a little bit. And the problem with going back the other way is it's very hard to factor anything like God into a scientific equation.
Well, I think at a more practical level, though, I think it's important to maintain that Gould separation by simply saying there are places and circumstances, the schools are among them, in which we deal with science, and there are other places in which we deal respectfully with religion, and some of the same people may go to both, but we don't try offer religious alternatives to science in the schools.
I can I just clarify something?
Sure.
I don't know if it was misunderstood, but by talking about the anthropic principle, I wasn't bringing in necessarily the idea that a god made it that way. You could interpret it that way, mm-hmm. but it could also be something like, why is the Earth placed where it is relative to the sun and other planets? People tried to find a reason for that. Well, in a way, the explanation is if it weren't where it is, we wouldn't be here to be asking the question because mm-hmm. it's exactly the right position. So mm-hmm. I just didn't want to go there. But I do agree in teaching. It's very funny. Very often students come to the conclusion that scientists cannot be religious. And a lot of them are very religious and a lot of them are not. But they do keep it quite separate.
Any predictions on what we're going to find from this Huygens probe going down to visit? Lord knows what's going to find under there.
Well, already from what they've seen, there seem to be all of these puzzles. So I'm just on the edge of their seat. There are these dark, flowing areas that nobody can seem to figure out. And apparently the reflections off what was supposed to be liquid that people were looking for weren't there. So I just can't wait. I mean, I'm very excited about this. It's sleeping now, I think.
Yeah.
And it's going to wake up just a few hours before it descends into the surface. And it has really good cameras on it. So it should be a great adventure.
We should take a little also. We should take a little office pool on how long the rovers will. What day the rovers will. They're going on like the rabbit there.
Yeah, that's right.
They're great.
And there was the little news blip about how I can't remember which one got a burst of energy, and so Stephen Squires told us he thought it was because the wind blew some dust off of it, possibly, or something like that.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Isn't there a great lesson in science communication there? If you're going to do something like that that's so difficult and so tricky, give a modest and cautious estimate about longevity and then blow everybody away when it succeeded.
Great idea. Or I have an alternative idea I'll tell you about in a second. We're talking about the 2005 science predictions on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Or you put a windshield wiper on the solar panels, which I couldn't figure out. They tried to explain to me why that would cost so much more money and weigh so much more to do that, but I don't buy it. I could get a $6.95. Anyhow, go ahead, Casey.
But, they did do a version of that in a way, because the last little rovers that went up, one of the problems was there were dust on the rocks that they couldn't get, or they wanted to get beneath the surface. So this time they took up a little, sandpaper thingy that just sanded away the surface. So every time they go with one of these, they bring new instruments that would be able to do things like that. I wouldn't be at all surprised if next time they went up with windshield wipers.
What would surprise? I'll ask. We just have a few minutes. Let me begin with throw it this out. You can think about it. What would surprise you if we found something? What kind? It's hard to predict something that you don't know to be happening in the future. But if we found, let's say, XYZ, that would surprise me. Casey, you have any thoughts on what would really surprise you to find? Would life on Mars if the rovers suddenly found something?
No.
That wouldn't surprise you.
I think that would be totally unsurprising, especially if they can get below the surface. Well, current life, maybe
current
more
life.
Far.
But how would you tell if they don't have instruments on there?
They don't have instruments, but they certainly could with a next generation that would be able to do the kind of chemical analysis that would tell you about that. That wouldn't be. I would be very... Well, this is a negative, though.
Yeah.
If we were able to find any news on, say, extra dimensions or, the Higgs boson, the source of matter before the new European accelerator goes online in 07. But those are things we're waiting for. Gravity wave detection, that would be very cool.
Right. I would be surprised if we had a reversal on stem cells research. I mean, I think it's going to happen, but not this year.
Reversal on the policy?
The policy.
Yeah, it's funny. That would have been a prediction I once would have made for this year.
Exactly.
And what
too.
Changed it was the California Initiative, because the California Initiative has basically created now an oasis for stem cell research in the United States. I think that in the absence of that, I have a feeling that there would have been enough popular call for more work, and that even within people within the research community who have been more or less supportive of the administration's position, which has been a minority of the research community, but I think that at that point the administration would have caved a little bit.
I think Don Kennedy, anything?
Well, I think that's a very interesting notion that, in fact, although surely none of the initiators intended it, the California Initiative and its success might actually take the Bush people off the hook. Curious.
Mm-hmm. They'll say there's enough money going into it in California. Why should we have to be involved?
Or at least say, you know, well, there are alternatives out there, and so we don't really need to change a federal policy. I had one other little thing I wanted to stick in there about something that might be a pleasant surprise. Some people are starting to do wholesale shotgun genomics on microbial communities in mines, in a cubic foot of soil, in a cubic liter of the Sargasso Sea. We don't know yet what those are turning up, but they're turning up large numbers of they're certainly turning up indications that there are large numbers of species that we haven't identified yet. What I'm hoping for the future is that there may eventually be some real insights into microbial ecology that tell us a lot about how these communities that we can seldom glimpse are really working.
Yeah, we can't cultivate 90% of them, can we?
That's right.
Yeah, that'd be a very interesting finding. That would be something. We've talked about that before, and people are taking the DNA apart now because they can't cultivate them and looking to see what they are. I want to thank you. We've run out of – we could go on forever, and we'll have to invite you all back to do that real soon. So I want to thank my guest, John Rennie, editor-in-chief of Scientific American, Casey Cole, science writer, currently on leave from the L.A. Times, and author of Mind Over Matter, Conversations with the Cosmos. And Don Kennedy, editor-in-chief of the Journal Science, joining us from Stanford, California. Happy New Year to you all, and thanks for joining us.
Happy New Year to you, Ira.
You too. Our program is produced by Erica Altman and Ed Heist and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our web producer and our director. Our interns are Corey Binns and Abby Leonard. And we had help today from Anne Marie Cunningham and NPR librarian Catherine Baer. If you'd like to write us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. Surf over to our website where we have Science Friday's Kids Connection. We make free material, teaching material from all of Science Fridays. Click on the Teachers button and you'll get the curricula you can download. You can also download Science Friday into your iPod on Real Audio or listen on audible.com and listen in real time on Real Audio. Have a great holiday. Happy New Year. I'm Ira Flatow in New York. Thank you.